Good evening, everyone. Nice to see you all. A lot of old friends here. I was able to spend the afternoon with Tim walking around the environs of the creek, seeing the salmon jump and many of them be caught, but hopefully many of them made it through. So it's really nice to be here. Jaron is here. Jaron and I sat side by side at Tassajara for several months, and my wife Bonnie made it up this time, and we're having a good day. So this is a little bonus to be able to come talk to you tonight. We've been doing some work in our Sangha on compassionate communication, we're calling it, with the small C's. We're doing an 8-week class on it and investigating many different aspects of our interpersonal communications and really finding a number of ways to bring our practice into that important area of our life. One of the resources we're using is the work that's done by, has been done by Marshall Rosenberg on nonviolent communication. You may be a little familiar with that system. But one of the essential things about it, the thing that's impressed me the most, is how they help us articulate basic human needs. And when we take responsibility for our feelings and say, well, I just need to be respected, for instance. And when the other person takes responsibility for their feelings and they say, oh, well, that sounds reasonable, I need to be respected too. And so there's a way to find a place to meet there. When we take responsibility for our feelings, that is, we're not blaming the way we feel on the other person, and we articulate these basic human needs, such as respect, connection, love even, empathy, being seen, having an opportunity to play, an opportunity to rest. It's kind of like when we share our suffering with another human being, and they share theirs with us, and we bear witness to each other, and we meet. So it's a beautiful thing. And they've systematized it to make it a little more accessible. For instance, there was one of our Sangha members last night, we had a class last night, he was recounting his practice over the week, and he said he and his wife got into a huge fight about where the bowl of Halloween candy was. He realized this was silly, but somehow it had become very important to him, and to her apparently, about the place where this bowl of Halloween candy was. And he's a pretty experienced practitioner, so he was able to kind of see through that ruse and look inward a little bit, and he discovered that he really just wanted to be consulted about things. It was like nobody consulted him about where to put things in the house, and things just got arranged and he felt left out. And then looking underneath that, he had this fear that he articulated of not being loved, of being ignored, right? Almost of being invisible. So, you know, that when we get to that point, that really speaks to our heart. And we've kind of lost sight of the Halloween candy bowl at that point. And it's a real chance to meet. And using this particular system, he might might on another day say something like, next time we rearrange the furniture, can I be involved in the process? You know, and that's something, a specific request like that is something that somebody could easily say yes to, right? Not such so much to ask. So we can meet once we discover and articulate these basic human needs. On Saturday, several of us went to the Monroe Prison where we have a meditation group. And it was kind of a trafficy day, and it was rainy. And because there were several of us, I had to drive a little extra on I-5 and go through the traffic and pick these other two folks up. We drove out to Monroe. It's about a 45-minute drive with no traffic. And we found when we got there that our program had been canceled. And so, you know, that's a little bit hard to take for a few moments there. And but then I wondered, okay, what is my response here? And most of our communication with these folks is done by email, so I decided, first of all, not to write it right away, right? You know, we know that's a good idea. And so I wrote it the next day or so, and I tried to be pretty clean about it. I wanted to describe the circumstances. First of all, did I really need to write something? You know, well, I think the communications were a problem, and I wanted to point that out. And I ended the email just saying, I'm wondering where the communications went awry. So, you know, that's not so bad, right? I did mention the traffic, and I did mention the rain, and I did mention that there were actually three of us that day, and actually one of the three had been approved particularly for a special visit on that day because he was a guest. So I did get those things in there. And, so I don't know, you know, what was the best thing to do there. But I did get a very heartfelt reply and apology from the chaplain, who I really like. And so I you know, said, that's no problem. I appreciate your support. And then today I got even another apology from the person who heads up the volunteer, all the volunteers there. So I didn't want to make them feel bad, you know, but anyway, I guess I did want, I want to be respected, and I also respect the communication process. And so anyway, I won't try to analyze that too much, but we try to find these basic human needs and try to meet them. Another thing we're doing as part of this class is we're reading Gregory Kramer, who is the author and teacher of this method of interpersonal meditation that he calls insight dialogue. And so he makes everything into interpersonal, right? He defines a practice, a Buddhist practice, in interpersonal terms, and has this system of actually meditating, he calls it, interpersonally by speaking and listening and pausing and reflecting. In the early chapters of his book, he talks about the Four Noble Truths, and he defines them in interpersonal terms, which was quite interesting for me. You know, interpersonal suffering, we don't always focus on that. Clearly, when we stop and think, much of our suffering has to do with interpersonal interactions. And then when he gets to the second noble truth, he talks about Buddha's teaching on the three types of desire. I don't know if you've run across this teaching or not, but according to something Buddha said, the three types of desire are the desire for sense pleasures, the desire for being, excuse me, and the desire for non-being. Well, what does that mean, really? You know, I was never very inspired by that teaching, nor was Gregory Kramer, apparently, until he defined it in interpersonal terms. And so he talks about these three desires in how they relate to our interpersonal interactions. Sense pleasures, interpersonal, we can imagine many of them, and some of them are just being distracted from our suffering by interpersonal interactions. Right? Remember the days when we were single and we would go to a party and flirting was this kind of high energy thing, right? And we weren't necessarily trying to get anything, but it was just very distracting and occupying of our minds, and often was just kind of something that we did to get away from other things or something. And these other two, though, are even more interesting. The desire for being. Now, of course, we have this built-in survival instinct that we want to continue to exist. And our ego certainly doesn't want to give away anything about our existence. But he talks about it in terms of the desire to be seen as the desire to be, and the desire and the fear of being invisible. When we're invisible, we don't exist interpersonally. And that makes sense to me. So how much of our activity has to do with being seen, you know, putting ourselves forward in some way so that we can be seen? And conversely, how much of our defensiveness or whatever stems from a fear of not being seen? Along some of the same lines, the fear of non-being, or the desire for non-being, is the desire not to be exposed for who we really are, and for it to be seen as an imposter or whatever, you know, at least a very bad person. And so the fear there then is to be exposed. And so I can see that, right? In interpersonal terms, the impulse to withdraw and not be seen, in part because of the fear of, well, they might see who I really am, is a pretty strong force in our life, I think. And something I can certainly relate to. And he talks about these as hungers, right? The hunger for sense pleasure, the hunger to be seen, the hunger to not be seen. When I started thinking about this for a while, I got a little confused about these, putting these two things together. So on the one hand, we have these basic human needs, which includes the desire to be seen and not to be invisible. And on the other hand, we have these described as hungers, which we know that it's pretty good if we reduce our reactivity to things, our reactivity to our to when we don't get what we want. So for instance, when somebody is angry at me, of course my normal response is to be defensive, but there are a few times when I've been able to just take it in, you know? Just, oh, here is a suffering human being expressing their anger, and it's things go much better that way. So I do aspire to allow these hungers to subside. You know, this hunger to be seen. When I'm, from a teacher's point of view, if I'm just saying, hey, you know, look at me, I can do this and I can do this, and I'll tell a joke, you know, that's not so good. It's not so helpful for people if that's where my teaching is coming from. So I would like that hunger to be seen to diminish if possible, or at least to be able to see it and work with it. So on the one hand, these basic human needs, if you will, are a place to meet. On the other hand, there's something that they create suffering for us. So what do I do here? How do I practice? How does a bodhisattva practice? You know, that's one of the questions that some of the great Mahayana sutras take up, like the Vimalakirti Sutra and the Diamond Sutra, and I'm sure there are others. How does a bodhisattva practice? How does a bodhisattva think? How does a bodhisattva act? These are the kind of driving questions of those Mahayana sutras. And usually they're answered in terms of not giving rise to a sense of a separate self or a lifetime or a being. And that's well and good, you know, from a certain point of view, but that takes me away from these basic human needs where I really feel I meet people and I feel like the separation between us can drop away. And that this really works with this idea of teasing apart the self or opening up the self so that real meeting can happen. And so I'm confused. I'm wondering how to proceed. Because another thing about trying to be seen, trying to get respect, these things really occupy our minds, right? They create a sense of grasping. And when we're grasping for things, we're just all caught up in our own little world of desires, and we're not open to life, we're not open to other people, we're not open to the moment. And yet it's so human, right? Do we have to give up our basic human wiring, our basic human heart, our basic human desires, and even these places where we meet in order to be more effective, be more helpful, more skillful as a bodhisattva? Vimalakirti, if you have read that sutra, he just storms in everywhere and lays everybody low, and he doesn't really talk about how the beings he helps. He just shows other aspiring bodhisattvas how they are falling short of the mark. So a bodhisattva, the thing I love about the bodhisattva ideal is that, in my mind, the bodhisattva has a human heart, right? The bodhisattva can love. I mean, we're not talking about getting rid of everything or allowing everything to be insubstantial. And we're talking about a heart that can love, I think. And so that's a gift, I think, that the Mahayana tradition gives us that wasn't so prevalent or wasn't so obvious in the Theravadan literature. So how does a bodhisattva love, and how does a bodhisattva, or does a bodhisattva retain their humanity? Maybe this was never a question for you, but it's been troubling me, so I've been thinking about this. Well, we can talk about two different perspectives. We can talk about and begin to really see that much of our life is lived from a self-centered perspective, right? This small self that wants what it wants, strives to get it, fears what it fears, expends a lot of effort not to get what it doesn't want, right? Stay away from, avoid the things we're afraid of and get the things we want. And we can see the more we practice what a kind of a crazy state of mind that is. You know, it's just, it's obscuring. It's a cloud. It's a noise in our mind that keeps us from being present, keeps us from being open to life, to all beings. So a bodhisattva, in my mind, works toward an all-centered perspective, right? All beings, and not an other-centered perspective, because it includes us. It includes all of our aspects. They're all beings that the Bodhisattva tends to. Right? So a Bodhisattva doesn't just tend to others, Bodhisattva tends to ourselves as well. Which was a revelation for me, you know, a while back. And I think our metta practices are based on that principle that the Bodhisattva heart loves all of our self-centeredness, and the Bodhisattva heart loves everybody else's self-centeredness, and the Bodhisattva heart loves all beings. So it's almost as if I have many different selves, right? I have this small self-centered self that wants to be seen and can get angry about things like the bowl of Halloween candy, certainly about being treated poorly at the prison, but I also have a Bodhisattva heart, or I am part of the Bodhisattva heart that can simply love these things and doesn't need them to be otherwise. And this self-centered me, if I study it more closely, is not a abiding thing, but it's a momentary arising. Right? It's like this storm of grasping arises in an instant and spreads its noise around, but sometimes subsides. And if we can think of it as momentary arisings, it's a lot more workable. And the Bodhisattva heart, I'd say, is like the ocean. I wouldn't dare say it's permanent, but it's huge, right? And it's like the momentary risings of the waves on the ocean. And the heart, the Bodhisattva heart. So the Bodhisattva heart is very, very big. So where I've come to in this investigation is that the Bodhisattva doesn't have to transcend anything, but a Bodhisattva works to create the conditions in which human beings flourish. So the conditions that we flourish in, like these needs we've been talking about, the needs for respect, the needs for community, for play, for rest, for self-expression, for all those things. So that I can have those needs on the one hand and work as a Bodhisattva on the other hand, and do my best to create the conditions in which I flourish and everyone else flourishes. And for me, that put my mind at ease and my heart at ease a little bit. So I can give myself to the work of creating conditions in which human beings, all beings, flourish. And then my little being can flourish there too. And because I need those things. I mean, I don't think I ever could give up all those things. And if I did, maybe I wouldn't be able to meet people there like I do. You know, if I didn't suffer, how could I meet someone with their suffering? If I too didn't feel the fear of being invisible, how would I be able to meet someone who is expressing that? I don't know. It seems like I would have lost something. So I'm not going to worry about that too much. I'm going to honor those things, and in my bodhisattva work, simply work to create those conditions. And I don't know about you, but these two selves, we're just talking about two, maybe there are more than two, but they kind of toggle back and forth sometimes. And the default condition seems to be the self-centeredness, right? You know, we can bring some awareness and switch and okay, yeah, it's pretty big. And then a moment later, it goes back. I don't know if there's a spring there or something, but somehow it's not a even balance. There's certainly decades of habit, if not lifetimes, that close us back up to our self-centeredness. But the more we, you know, exercise that pivot, the more natural it becomes. And sometimes, like this morning, for instance, I look back on something I said the night before in class, and I thought, oh, man, you know, that, you know, maybe it's a joke I tried to make, and jokes are good, right? Because they loosen people up, and laughing is good, but sometimes they can go a little bit astray, and oops, maybe I shouldn't have said that. Because I don't want to hurt somebody, and I don't want to be seen as somebody that's unskillful. These human but somewhat self-centered concerns. And so if I'm grounded, I can say, okay, I see what's going on. Can I bring metta to myself? You know, can I tap into this bodhisattva heart that can hold my foibles and my fears? And yes, I think we can. And that same heart then inspires us to continue to practice. And one place we can notice this, if sometimes we do have difficulty noticing, I know I practiced for at least 5 years, and I can remember going to my teacher and saying, you know, we say these bodhisattva vows, but hey, I'm not feeling it, you know. I'm not sure what I'm supposed to be feeling here, but I'm still pretty self-absorbed. But we can see these two minds clearly, I think, when we notice how the mind of giving, true giving, is quite a bit different than the mind of grasping. So just, you know, if we just pay attention to those, we can begin to get a sense of the mind of giving is not grasping, right? Opening the hands. And then when we're not grasping, we're kind of still. We're kind of grounded because we're not trying to get anything. We're not afraid of not getting something. We're just giving, kind of calm, kind of joyful, not attached to outcome. And so we can touch that here. I always love the earth-touching posture of Shakyamuni Buddha, tapping into that larger, oceanic bodhisattva heart. So perhaps these constructs that I've been working with tonight are useful, and they're not uncommon, the self-centered self that we get to know more and more as we practice, and the bodhisattva heart, which we also get to know. Before, we didn't know there were such things, either one. And so we find these useful constructs that help us see more clearly how our life is operating, how the world operates, how the self operates. And yet we have to remember that they're just constructs, because once we divide things, we can so easily denigrate one and elevate the other. Like, I would really like to be the Bodhisattva, and I'm getting a little tired of these self-centered sufferings. We have to keep that in mind. And sometimes I think it's just, well, I just want to love life, right? I want to be lived by the one life. But in order to do that, I need to look closely. And in order to do that, I need some tools. So going forward, if my mission can be offering myself in the work of creating conditions in which beings flourish, human beings and other beings, it feels pretty solid, pretty open, pretty grounded.